Farm Bill affects food, ag, and rural America. It's a gigantic law that will cost $867 billion.
People often forget the fact that we invest in rural communities through the Farm Bill, so economic development, and everything from helping cover costs of like water, wastewater facilities to rural hospitals and, you know, even things like the fire department.
That's former USDA Administrator Jonathan Kappas. He joins us along with Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach. Plus, a new report says that some Department of Corrections officers are abusive with mentally ill inmates. Here's court-ordered psychiatrist Dr. Pablo Stewart.
You get a group of individuals who are traumatized, in my opinion, that then puts them at risk of developing this culture of abuse and retaliation.
We'll hear more about that from Illinois Public Media's Christine Herman. And this year, Amazon is delivering real Christmas trees right to your door. Are more traditional tree retailers worried about this? All of that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's show, the final version of the Farm Bill is finally making its way through Congress. We'll break down just how much is in the law and how it affects us here in Illinois. And we'll hear from some U of I students who designed a satellite that will launch into space this evening. But first, we begin with our prison system and the way it treats inmates with mental illness. A new report by a court-appointed psychiatrist says the Illinois Department of Corrections continues to flounder in this area. Dr. Pablo Stewart was appointed after a lawsuit settlement in 2016 regarding a lack of adequate mental health care in state prisons. And he says he's convinced the staff are abusing mentally ill inmates at one correctional center in Pontiac. Just on the heels of this, another report from a national nonprofit called Forward.us says Illinois prisons are nearly 40% over capacity. We'll tweet out a link to that story. But Illinois Public Media's Christine Herman has been reporting on the state of mental health in prisons, and she joins me in the studio. Christine, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's start with what that new report about inmates with mental illness, what does it tell us?
Right. So this was in response to a 2016 lawsuit settlement, which laid out many requirements, changes that the Department of Corrections was supposed to make to ensure they're providing constitutionally adequate mental health treatment to inmates who have mental illness, about 12,000 estimated to have that type of mental health condition. So Dr. Stewart, as you mentioned, was appointed to oversee those changes, and he's visited several of the facilities, more than a dozen for this most recent report, interviewed employees and inmates there, and he reports that there are improvements in some areas, like the way that prison facilities do screening of inmates for mental illness. They've reduced the number of people who are in restrictive housing, which is the term they use to refer to segregation or solitary confinement. But they're floundering in other areas, like staffing in particular. The lack of staff is underlying many of the issues that they continue to see in the prisons.
Sure. And when we say staffing as it relates to mental health treatment, what kinds of staffing are we talking about here?
So there's a shortage of psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, social workers, and as well as just other general prison staff, corrections officers and other staff. So without the staff, without the appropriate number of people working within the facilities, they can't provide the level of treatment, the amount of treatment that is needed by the inmates there who are sick.
Okay. The report singles out Pontiac Correctional Center, about an hour northeast of Bloomington. Dr. Stewart says he found, quote, a culture of abuse and retaliation there. Can you describe what that means?
Yeah. So he says he's absolutely convinced after doing hundreds of interviews with inmates and staff at these facilities that mentally ill inmates at Pontiac are being physically assaulted or retaliated against in the form of having their food withheld or not being able to get visits or phone calls. He also says he's found evidence of intimidation of the mental health workers by some of the other employees. And, you know, he says he's seeing inmates who have mental illness with injuries, trauma to their faces, newly missing teeth, the type of thing that if he had encountered that in his practice, he would be obligated to report to the police. So he says he does not take these allegations, he takes this very seriously when he's calling this out.
Should mention here that we have reached out to the Illinois Department of Corrections to join us as well, but they declined. Christine, how has IDOC responded to you?
Yeah. So they say in a statement, they said they take, you know, swift action to investigate any allegations of abuse. I also spoke with Director Baldwin, who told me the similar thing. He also just emphasized they've made many new hires, but they're still short, obviously. They've built several new mental health facilities, but they're still not up to capacity, largely due to staffing issues. And they are working to change the culture and helping corrections staff learn how to interact with and engage with inmates who have a mental illness. Late October, a federal judge stepped in to issue a motion to enforce the mental health lawsuit settlement. And the judge said that the Department of Corrections has been deliberately indifferent to inmates with mental health issues. And I asked Director Baldwin if he thinks that's a fair assessment. Here's what he said.
No, we do not think it's a fair assessment. But I can understand the court's frustration with this as well. This case has been hanging on for a very long time. And it was only in the last 3.5 years that Illinois decided we needed a response. So we have a lot of ground to make up, but we are making up that ground very, very expeditiously. And I have no doubt as we continue to work with the court and the court monitor, every report is going to become better and better.
That's Illinois Department of Corrections Director John Baldwin speaking with Christine Herman. I've been talking with her about a new report assessing how IDOC treats mentally ill inmates. Now, Alan Mills joins us on the line. He's with the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. Hi there, Alan. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Is what we're hearing about Pontiac an isolated case, Alan?
No, it's not. It's an extreme case, but it's not isolated. We have seen the same problems at the other maximum security prisons, particularly at Menard Correctional Center, as well as at some of the medium security prisons.
And we're hearing about understaffing and also some inappropriate staff treatment. Let's talk about the lack of staff first. Christine, why is this such a problem?
Well, Dr. Stewart says in his report that it just creates ripple effects. So when there's a shortage, they're not able to provide treatment to the inmates who need it. That might result in behaviors that would be exhibited as a result of untreated mental illness, such as violent outbursts and behaviors that are difficult to handle and to manage. So that can lead to staff burnout and a lot of turnover. You know, Director Baldwin says they're trying to work to recruit more people into these positions, but it's a very tough environment to work with. And by just having some of their prison staff work overtime, you know, the judge has pointed out that's not a sustainable solution.
Alan, I'd like to get your perspective on that as well. Your thoughts on why it's such a problem here.
Well, I think that the problem is as Christine noted, a cultural one. And Dr. Stewart has harped on this since he's come to Illinois over 2 years ago. And I think the problem is that we view mental illness as a disciplinary problem rather than as a medical problem. It is unquestionable that people who have an untreated mental illness can be very difficult to deal with. Somebody who is in a psychotic state and does not understand reality and sees, as one gentleman has been described, a black hole on the side of his cell which demands blood, and he's afraid that he will have to give it so much blood that he will ultimately die. And as, in order to attempt to appease the black hole in the wall of his cell, he continually cuts himself and bleeds in the cell. Somebody like that is going to be very difficult for a correctional officer to deal with. But the answer is not to use force against that person. The answer is to provide good medical care to everybody who needs it. And if that is done, then I think the prison would become much safer for both staff and for prisoners themselves. And the answer here is to staff up particularly the mental health staff, but also the custody staff. Custody staff who are at the end of their second shift in a row, so who've been working for 16 hours in this high-stress environment, is somebody that no one wants to deal with because they're ready to snap. I mean, I know that when I've been up for 16 hours working hard, I get very short-tempered, and frankly, my job is way less stressful than that of a correctional officer.
Yeah, and
so
yeah.
I have no doubt that actually increasing the number of security staff would matter, but the basic problem is you don't have enough mental health staff. And just to cite sort of an extreme example, about three-quarters of the so-called group therapy that's provided at Pontiac Correctional Center consists of putting 10 to 50 men in front of a TV screen and watching a movie. That's what counts as mental health treatment at Pontiac. And the reason they do that is because they have no alternative, because they don't have enough staff to provide the one-on-one therapy, the traditional group therapy, the medication management that is needed to actually make somebody better.
Christine, back to you here. One thing I've been trying to think about a little bit is how does staff figure out if an inmate is acting a certain way because of a mental illness that needs to be treated or whether it's for other reasons?
Yeah, I visited one of the new mental health facilities that was created in response to the lawsuit settlement in Joliet. It's a treatment center for inmates who have some of the most serious mental illnesses. About 100 out of about 5,000 inmates who have serious mental illness have been transferred to this facility. The warden there says that they work with the mental health staff to try to make determinations whether a behavioral issue is related to the mental illness or not, whether it warrants increased treatment or deserves consequences such as the removal of certain privileges like recreation time and other things. But, you know, as Ellen pointed out, there are many other facilities. Joliet Treatment Center has been doing a pretty good job of providing constitutionally adequate care, according to the latest report. But many other facilities' treatment is limited to one 15 to 20 minute session a month. And at Pontiac, the severe staffing shortage there means most inmates don't even get that. So that causes ripple effects. They can't respond by increasing treatment to those inmates because they just simply don't have the staff to do so.
And Alan, what's actually happening? You know, when inmates are diagnosed with mental illness, do they get treated any differently than when some kind of a behavior issue arises?
Generally, no, other than maybe worse, because they don't comply with orders, because they're seriously mentally ill. And to go back to answer your prior question, I think the answer is that if somebody is on the mental health caseload, first of all, correctional staff have to be made aware of that fact. And second of all, a mental health professional should be called in on the spot to make that determination. Correctional officers are not qualified to make a determination as to whether or not this is certain actions are a result of a mental illness or whether they are in fact some other cause. But mental health professionals are. And it's the very fact that there aren't enough mental health professionals to make those judgments that means that correctional officers are put in the impossible situation of a lay person untrained in mental health making a decision as to whether or not this person needs treatment or needs to discipline. And the default for correctional officers is always discipline.
Christine, do we know why this understaffing is happening? Is it budget reasons, something else, just because it's such a hard job? What are some of the reasons here?
That's a great question. When I asked Director Baldwin this question, he said that there's just a shortage of mental health workers in general across the country, but also corrections is a tough environment to work in. And I did want to point out, you know, I spoke with Dr. Stewart last week after this report came out, and he said he really wanted to make a clear point that the corrections staff themselves are suffering from trauma-related conditions from working in a tough environment. And his suggestion to the Department of Corrections is first and foremost, these staff need more support because they are more prone to acting out and retaliating against inmates. Not that that's an excuse for such behavior, but when they suffer from trauma themselves from being physically assaulted or sexually harassed on the job, that can just create, you know, more problems. There's just this cycle. So that was something that he really wanted to make a clear point. And IDOC says in the past 2 years they have created increased more support and programs and resources for prison staff with regards to that.
Alan, your perspective on some of the reasons behind the understaffing?
Largely it's money. Illinois spends right at the bottom of all 50 states. I think we're at like 44 or so among the 50 states on how much we spend per prisoner on medical care. And frankly, we've been allowed to get away with underfunding our prison system for decades. This is not a problem that's brand new. As Director Baldwin himself admitted, they essentially ignored our lawsuit for the first 7 years that it was pending and made no meaningful changes at all. But there has been a lack of litigation over the years to force the department to do it. And as I always say, prisoners have a really crappy lobby in Springfield. You know, they don't have an army of lobbyists to make sure that their interests are protected. So it's very easy for legislatures to, on the one hand, say the solution to any sort of social problem is lock more people up, and then on the other hand, actually cut the department's budget, which is exactly what we've seen over the last decade, is while the number of prisoners has increased, the department's budget has decreased, and therefore they've simply had to do more with less. Dr. Baldwin is only partly right that there's a shortage of mental health workers nationwide. There's a shortage of psychiatrists nationwide. And we've urged the department to use more psychiatric nurses and other people who have prescribing authority as long as they are appropriately supervised by psychiatrists. So psychiatrists don't have to do all of the work that they're doing in the Department of Corrections. But the solution to shortage of workers is the same one that every employer in the country uses. If there aren't enough workers, you offer them more money until you get enough employees. It's really simple. And the state of Illinois has decided they're not going to do that, and that's the basic problem.
Christine, running a little bit short on time, we've got about 90 seconds left here, but what are your thoughts, what have you learned about what is coming next? After this report, what are some next steps here?
Alan, maybe you can chime in on this one. I understand that's just the terms of the lawsuit. It will continue to be overseen by Dr. Stewart.
Right.
But yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Let me just very briefly, later this week, there is a hearing before the judge as to exactly what remedy he's going to enter. Once the judge makes that decision, we'll know more specifically what new requirements the department is supposed to meet in order to actually fulfill its constitutional obligations.
All right, very good. We'll leave that there. But to Alan Mills with the Uptown People's Law Center, thank you so much for joining us for this segment. Christine Herman, health reporter for Illinois Public Media, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for having us.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square, December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. $867 billion. That's the amount of money in the 2018 Farm Bill. It's a huge piece of legislation that's normally renewed every 5 years, and it touches all of our lives in some way, whether it's the SNAP program, crop insurance for farmers, or rural economic development. It's also historically been fairly bipartisan, but this time around, the bill was caught in a contentious political fight over proposed changes to the SNAP program. And after the last Farm Bill expired on October 1st, our lawmakers in Washington hadn't agreed on how to renew it. Well, late Monday, we finally got the Farm Bill. It has bipartisan support in both chambers, and the Senate passed it yesterday by a big margin. And we'll talk now about how all of this will affect Illinois and the Midwest. Joining me in our Urbana studios is Jonathan Kappas. He served in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and is now director of the Gardner Agriculture Policy Program at the University of Illinois. And Grant Gerlach is with us from the studios of NET News in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he reports for them and for Harvest Public Media. Jonathan and Grant, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks,
good
Brian.
Morning.
Grant, I'll start with you. I imagine it's been all hands on deck for you and all the folks at Harvest since you cover food and farming. One reason why is just because of how much ground this giant law covers. Just how wide-ranging is the Farm Bill, and how does it really affect all of us in ways we might not even realize?
Well, the Farm Bill, it's a large bill. The one that they're voting on spends around almost $870 billion over 10 years, and it can range from nutrition programs to farm support programs to rural development to forestry. It covers a lot of different areas, research, but there are a couple that I would highlight that do affect people even if they don't think about it. One is the nutrition programs in the Farm Bill, in particular SNAP, and this is where most of the money in the Farm Bill goes, is to nutrition programs. And there are some 40 million Americans enrolled in SNAP over recent months. It's the largest hunger program in the country. And when it comes to meeting the basic needs of all Americans, making sure everybody has enough food to eat, children and families, you know, it's really important. And that's part of the Farm Bill. Another one is the crop insurance and commodity support programs that pay farmers when prices crash. That provides a lot of stability to farmers and farm businesses. And by virtue of that, it provides stability in the food supply and in food prices, because farming is often a boom and bust business, but you don't really feel that in the grocery store. You don't have a dollar for a gallon of milk one day and $5 the next day. It stays pretty even and steady. And then a last one is conservation programs. You know, farms can have an impact on water quality and air quality. They're often exempt from clean air and water laws, row crop farms in particular. But there are a lot of financial incentives in the Farm Bill that encourage farmers to adopt practices that can improve water and air and soil, and also set aside land for wildlife habitat.
Jonathan, to you, in addition to formerly working in the USDA and now being at the U of I, you published a book earlier this year about the Farm Bill called The Fault Lines of Farm Policy. Has the federal government always put all of this legislation, SNAP, rural economic development, farm policy, into one bill? And why do we do this?
Yeah, no, that's the big question that kind of helped spark the work on the book. Throughout history, we've really been helping farmers out since the New Deal and Dust Bowl, the 1930s. The food stamps, or the food assistance part of this, really comes into play in the 1960s, and then they were combined in a bill in 1973. So we've been kind of operating with this large scale, as Grant did a great job of sort of hitting all the major points of this. But this, if you think about the coalition that it takes to get your votes in Congress, right, we've been kind of working this farm and non-farm interest coalition through food stamps, food assistance, and farm assistance since the mid-70s.
Okay. And given all that, I wonder if we can talk about some of the bigger portions of the Farm Bill, starting with the SNAP program that Grant mentioned, more commonly known as food stamps. You said this was put into the Farm Bill in about 1973. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, there's actually a pretty long history in which the farm support system that was created out of the New Deal kind of falls apart in the 50s and 60s for a host of reasons, not the least of which we had too much grain and the programs weren't working. And then with the politics changing around Congress, so a lot of people had been moving off the farms, moving into towns, cities, and suburbs. And so your voting coalitions, your voting realities in Congress really shift in that 1950s, 60s range. And so as that broke down on the farm side, there's quite a bit of dispute amongst farm interest groups, particularly Midwestern corn growers and Southern cotton growers, about what policy should look like. And when they kind of butted heads to a point of not being able to get a bill done, then you saw leadership in Congress look for ways to kind of build out a coalition to get more votes and kind of bring everybody to a larger table in order to get this thing moving.
Okay, and hence trying to maybe bring some more urban interests into supporting a piece of legislation like this by including food assistance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see it then build a bridge, if you will, to the non-rural districts, which were dwindling in the House in particular, and be able to connect up these two aspects. I mean, ultimately, we think of farming as producing food, right? So the idea of connecting this kind of makes a lot of sense, that we're helping farmers deal with the risks of producing food, but at the same time, we have a significant amount of people in this country who struggle to put food on the table. And so helping them do so obviously helps them out directly, but certainly is going to have some sort of residual benefits for the farmers themselves.
Grant, back to this particular piece of legislation. This time around, SNAP was one of the reasons why the bill took so long to pass. What was that debate mainly about?
That debate was about work requirements for people who are in the SNAP program. And it would have built upon the existing work requirements. So right now, some beneficiaries in the SNAP program do have to work at least 20 hours a week or go to job training in order to stay in the SNAP program. And that includes people from 18 to 49 years old, people with no children or dependents. And in this farm bill, House Republicans wanted to expand that group up to people up to 59 years old, people with children over 6 years old. And that would have doubled the number of people who fall under those work requirements to around 7 million people. And the reason they wanted to do that was to nudge people into the workforce. They said it's a time of low unemployment. There are more people who should be available to fill the jobs that are open, and they were looking to this group in SNAP. It had a lot of opponents. Many people were pointing out that many people in SNAP already work, and they felt like it created a system where they have to check off this box where that they're working 20 hours a week. But if they slip up, they could lose access to SNAP. At a certain point, they could lose it entirely. So Senate Democrats sort of stood up against this House proposal and said they would not pass a farm bill that included these expanded work requirements. And that set up this standoff that lasted most of this farm bill debate and was really only resolved after the midterms, because when House Democrats won control of the House going forward in 2019, it was clear that there was sort of the time was running out for Republicans if they wanted to have the most influence they could on this farm bill. They had to get it passed, and that meant they had to get it through the Senate. And so that's when they dropped those expanded work requirements.
Gotcha. And much of this bill is fairly similar to what was in the last one. There are a few exceptions. One of those, Grant, is the legalization of hemp. What does this mean?
This is going to be really interesting to see how this plays out and kind of how it grows across the country. What they're planning to pass in the farm bill means that states can legalize hemp production. And they could already do that on a limited basis, and many states have taken those steps. It varies a lot. In Nebraska, we allow it only for some small research purposes. In states like Colorado, they've gone a lot farther. A lot of what this is meant to do is to clear up confusion about, number one, what counts as hemp. The rules in the farm bill will be that it has to include 0.3% of THC or less. THC is the part of marijuana that gets you high. So it'll clear up that. It sort of sets a basic definition for hemp. They're hoping it'll clear up a lot of confusion over crossing state lines with hemp that is produced, or, you know, just taking care of some of these cross-state issues that come up. And so it sets up a situation where we have sort of this, it's not a new cash crop, it was around a long time ago, but it's new to farmers who are practicing today, and it could potentially be very lucrative growing it for either industrial products or for CBD oil, which some people use for medicinal purposes. And so what I'm interested to see is what kind of industry pops up and where it pops up. There will be a lot of people rushing to try to create a foothold on the infrastructure that's needed and the equipment that's needed, because it's not just switching from corn to hemp. You have to have the right equipment and a place to take it after you grow it. So that'll be fascinating to see how it plays out.
We're discussing the Farm Bill with Jonathan Kappas and Grant Gerlach. And Jonathan, when we look at Illinois, ag certainly remains a big industry. What are some of the biggest ways that this Farm Bill affects farmers in our state?
Yeah, well, absolutely. To Grant's point, we don't know yet about how the hemp will affect Illinois farmers and what kind of opportunities will show up there. But traditionally, the big ways that a farm bill affects farmers in the state, obviously the farm program payments, so those payments that help typically with lower prices, which we have seen a significant run of lower prices mm-hmm. since the last farm bill, in fact. The crop insurance provisions, which are key arguably the key tool that farmers have to manage risk, from weather risk to that inside the crop year price risk. So, you know, what I plant, I sink in the ground is a cost that I have to get back out of harvest. And so helping manage through that risk is a big part of it. And then also the conservation programs. In fact, I would argue that the conservation programs, while having some controversy and some issues in this bill, are over the long run and probably into the future going to be a bigger and bigger part of this conversation. Because of things for Illinois in particular, like the nutrient loss reduction strategy. So this concern about fertilizers that we're using in the farms getting into our waterways. Mm-hmm. And these conservation programs represent a big investment in helping farmers manage that. Because, again, it's for something like nutrients, right, it's very dependent on the weather. And so there's a risk factor that we're used to dealing with and trying to produce crops, but now we're trying to think about how we adjust production to deal with the water quality issues that come about.
All right. We did reach out to the Illinois Farm Bureau for comment. They said overall they're pleased with the final text of the bill. They were frustrated that it took so long to pass. Grant, I'd like your perspective on how the impact of the Farm Bill differs, say, among big farmers, large producers, and ag organizations like the Farm Bureau versus maybe smaller farmers here in Illinois and across the Midwest.
Well, when it comes to very small farms like, small produce farms, people producing for farmers markets or CSAs, that kind of thing, there will be some additional money. And I guess the way that folks who support these things look at it, permanent money, less guesswork whether these programs will stick around that support those kinds of farms with grant money for marketing purposes, promotional purposes, setting up farm-to-table programs for schools, setting up regional systems that help create more scale of the markets that those smaller farms can produce for. So those are things that they can be looking for. A lot of it is tailored to provide stability to those mid-size and larger farms. Larger farms can weather things from year to year better just by the scale of their operation. But they also make use of these programs. It kind of runs the gamut. Overall, there's more money for probably the larger, row crop farms and commodity farms than there are for the smaller produce farms.
You've both been following this for a long time, and there's certainly a lot in this bill. We won't be able to get to it all. I want to take a little bit of a step back and ask a little bit about how this bill got passed. Grant, is it fair to say that this time around the Farm Bill was more polarizing than it has been in years past?
You can look at two sides of that, and those two sides would be the House and the Senate. It was more polarizing in the House. It was pretty conventional the way Farm Bills go in the Senate, though. So in terms of being more polarizing in the House, we talked about that debate over the SNAP issues. When that came out of committee in the House, it basically shut things down in terms of coming to some bipartisan deal. Once it was clear the House wanted to pass that provision, Democrats weren't interested at all. But on the Senate side, it was pretty bipartisan from the start. And so the bill you end up with looks more like the Senate bill because they had to come to some compromises. A lot of the big stands that House Republicans took, most of those things fell away in the end.
Jonathan, back to your book, which is titled Fault Lines of Farm Policy. Where are those fault lines, not just in Congress, but among Americans more generally?
Yeah, well, the book focuses a lot on the congressional and sort of political fault lines. And what we see are very regional-based fault lines when it comes to the farm program. So, again, that Midwestern corn-based interest that we see here, the southern crops, cotton, rice, and peanuts, which have their own sort of power base there in the south. And then you see kind of the western plains where we see a lot, where most of the wheat production happens. And so that's kind of the farm-based set of it. And then, of course, the fault line with SNAP, the food assistance programs. Line there with conservation policy as well. And so we kind of see these, where you see the coalitions come together, right? That's kind of where they butt heads and there's some friction about how these bills play out. And to Grant's point, we saw that very clearly in the House this year. And again, this is the second time in a row. The 2013 Farm Bill in the House was also defeated, also over SNAP and controversial changes about work. And so it was a little surprising, I think, to the point the Illinois Farm Bureau made. There's a lot of frustration with how long it took. And some of that's due because we would have thought maybe we learned that lesson from the last time, that this isn't a path forward to pick this fight right on this key coalitional fault line, if you will, between food assistance and farm assistance.
Sure. Grant, just about a minute left, but I know you talk to farmers regularly in your reporting. What have they said to you just about the fact that this bill took so long to pass?
Right. Frustration. They were looking for certainty. They wanted to know what they're dealing with. And, if it passes the House this afternoon, they'll have a much better idea. They want to know what they're dealing with, especially when it comes to crop insurance. And their bankers want to know what they're dealing with when it comes to crop insurance as they sort of, set up their loans for next year. And if it passes, then they'll have much more certainty on that. And that'll be good because there's still a lot of uncertainty in other areas like trade with China. Are they going to buy more soybeans in the near future or not? And when is that going to happen? So to have the Farm Bill ready and done and over with will be one less thing that they need to be concerned about in the coming winter months.
Grant Gerlach with NET News in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Harvest Public Media. Jonathan Kappas, former USD administrator and professor at the University of Illinois. Thanks, both of you, for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Support for the 21st comes from Sock Club, delivering new designs of socks each month made with cotton grown and knit in the southeastern United States. Gift subscriptions are available this holiday season to keep friends and family in socks year-round. More information is available online at sockclub.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Some Central Illinois scientists are hitching a ride to space tonight, or at least their satellite is. It's called CubeSail, and it was designed and built by CU Aerospace and engineering students from the U of I. And tonight at 10, it will tag along on a ride launched by NASA from New Zealand. Michael Lembeck is an associate professor at the U of I's Department of Aerospace Engineering and the director of the Laboratory for Advanced Systems. David Carroll is a principal investigator at CU Aerospace, and Dawn Hawken is the student project lead working on CubeSail. She's a senior studying electrical engineering. They're all with me in our studios in Urbana. All three of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Michael, let's start with you. Most of us have never seen a satellite, let alone built one for launch into orbit. Can you describe a little bit about what CubeSail is in lay terms?
Sure. If you imagine a couple of bread boxes put together end to end, that's about the size of the satellite. The two satellites are actually operate independently and have a thin film that'll be unrolled between them, which will create a sail that solar pressure and other things can work on in order to serve as a sort of propellantless propulsion.
Very nice. And I was being serious when I said the satellite is hitching a ride. David, can you tell us a little bit about that aspect of this project?
Sure. So we are part of NASA ELENA program, which is a CubeSat launch initiative program, where they paid for the satellite. And now they're going to launch it for free because that's an expensive proposition. Anyway, it is on a Rocket Lab Electron launch vehicle, and that they are both, they're principally a United States company, but they have a New Zealand branch, and their launch site right now is out there.
All right, very good. Dawn, of course, you're a student here at the University of Illinois. Tell us a little bit about your role in this project.
So I've been the student lead for this project for about 2 to 2.5 years. When I started out, we were still working on building the satellite. We rebuilt a lot of the hardware. I was also director of engineering for our student organization, so I organized weekly meetings and kept up on top of everyone as far as what they were working on, got things ordered, stepped in to help in a hands-on way where I could, and I also did a lot of the licensing. We had to get licenses from the FCC and from the International Telecommunications Union in order to operate our ground stations so we could talk to the satellite and to operate the radio on the satellite, and then also a license from NOAA so that we could take images of the sail when it was in space. So I did a lot of paperwork to make sure that we could get up there and helped keep the students on track.
What was it like navigating all of that paperwork?
It was a little bit of a nightmare because in a lot of cases we were doing the same paperwork that these really big companies do when they were launching, you know, these multi-million dollar TV satellites. So it was interesting. I learned a lot.
For sure. Michael, what's the goal of the launch?
Well, the goal of the launch really is to educate students, folks like Dawn. And so, you know, regardless of what happens tonight, I've already declared mission success. We have a number of students from across the engineering campus in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, aerospace engineering that have all worked together to come to this point. And from that point of view, give them a little bit of industry experience, something to look forward to when they go out and start their careers.
And Dawn, what have you learned so far in this process? What are you hoping to gain from the satellite launch and its time in orbit?
I've learned pretty much everything I know about engineering and about the space industry from working with this group. It's the main thing that I do outside of classes. It takes a lot of my time and a lot of the other students' time, but we all find it to be worth it. Learned a lot of basic engineering skills and communication skills, leadership skills, working with people. It's been a great experience, and it's really exciting to see it finally go into space.
David, you went to U of I for your bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees. Did you always plan on kind of sticking around this area and working in Illinois, or how did that evolve?
Honestly, an astronaut wannabe that didn't quite make it. So the next best thing was to be able to launch something into space that we were a part of.
Yeah, for sure. Michael, how can people watch this launch tonight?
There will be a live stream on the internet from rocketlab.com. So around 10 o'clock, maybe a little before then, I should be able to tune in. We have, I think, right now about a 50% chance, given the weather conditions in New Zealand. So if it doesn't happen tonight, it'll be tried again probably on a number of successive nights. But the live stream is the best way to watch it tonight.
Right, very good. And Dawn, what's next for you? Hopes to work on another launch someday, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, ideally I'd like to work for NASA someday and work on some of these bigger science missions. But for now, I'm applying to the U of I and hoping to get a master's in aerospace engineering.
All right. When we've tweeted out the link where you can watch the launch of this live as well, we'll have that at our Twitter account, 21STShow. Exciting night for everyone involved. Michael Lembeck, Dawn Hawken, David Carroll, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the satellite launch here on the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For those of you who celebrate Christmas, what are your Christmas tree traditions? Maybe you have an artificial tree you assemble every year. Maybe you visit the local lot and take one home. Maybe you even head out to the fields and cut down your own tree. Some people can even buy a real tree online. In fact, Amazon now offers this. One thing's for sure, every family has their own traditions when it comes to trees. And joining me now is someone who knows a little bit about tradition. George Richardson's family has been farming in Spring Grove, Illinois since 1836. Every year, they welcome thousands of visitors to Richardson Adventure Farm to cut down their own Christmas trees from their 130 acres near the border with Wisconsin. And also joining me on the line, I have Chris Hohenstein, the founder of City Tree Delivery. In addition to three tree lots in the city of Chicago and one in the western suburb of Elmhurst, Chris's company also offers the option of shopping online and delivery. George and Chris, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
George, your style of Christmas tree shopping, where you go out into the field and cut one down yourself, I think is maybe one most folks think of when they think of Christmas trees. When people arrive at Richardson Adventure Farm, what do they do?
Well, typically, we have hundreds of saws. The people borrow a saw. If it's weekdays, they'll drive out to the fields themselves and choose their tree, get it back to the barn, and we have a whole crew of boys that shake and bale the trees and wrap them up for them. Free hot chocolate inside. Weekends, we run 7 or 8 tractors with wagons that are taking people out to the fields. It's about 1/2 mile to 3/4 mile out to the farthest field. So we try to make that really convenient for them.
And George, why do you think this style of Christmas tree shopping has lasted as long as it has? Why do you think people like it so much?
Well, this is a way to create a memory, to have a really something enjoyable with the kids and the dogs and grandma and grandpa, and really make an experience out of getting your Christmas tree. And I realize that not everyone has the time or the gumption, and so this isn't for everybody, but a lot of people are looking for that whole experience and something they're really going to remember.
And Chris, to you, you started City Tree Delivery back in 2009, and how is what your company offers different than some other Christmas tree lots?
We just tried something different. We started online. We used a way to offer sustainable convenience. It was really important for us to offer, the best locally harvested products and quality accessories, and offer a full circle. So we wanted to be able to deliver the tree, set it up, and then recycle it at the end of the year. And it's really perfect for busy families, people who have never had a tree before, people who have had an artificial tree, and we can kind of convert them into the real tree. It's for people who live in the city. They might not have a car, we're just trying to make it easy, and we want to make sure we have the focus of quality, service, and convenience.
And Chris, fewer than 3% of the 27 million real Christmas trees purchased last year were bought online. That data, according to the National Christmas Tree Association. You were one of the first people to offer online in shopping in Chicago about a decade ago. In your experience, do people use online ordering a lot for this?
They do. Those numbers were the same when I researched it back in 2009. I think it was 2% back then. But people are definitely, the numbers are definitely growing, and I think that's the future, at least for us. Many people buy on the lot the first year or two, and then they end up converting with online convenience because it's the same trees, the same quality, and it's really the best way. I for a lot of people, it's a great way for a great future.
And George, back to you. We certainly do live in the age of technology, as Chris was mentioning there. Do you worry about younger generations still being interested in buying real Christmas trees from the field?
No, I don't. And research tells us that the 20 and 30 year olds, that generation, is looking for family experiences. And so I believe if it is convenient and they have time, that's something that they're going to want to do. I also believe that Chris performs a valuable service. He's in the real tree business also, and I'm 100% behind that because this is not for everybody driving an hour out to the farm and, slogging through possible mud or something. So if you can provide something that's convenient and, really handy for people, it's still a real Christmas tree. They're going to get the freshness, they're going to get the scent, and all those things are very important for us.
Chris, this year Amazon has announced that they're joining the Christmas tree delivery game. Are you worried about the effect that could have on your business?
No, I believe Amazon's bringing awareness. For what Amazon's doing, we were able to actually do that 10 years ago. You could always get a tree delivered in a box from a farm. What Amazon's not doing at the moment is, like, one thing we offer is bringing a tree inside the home with people versus a tree showing up in a box at your door. We offer the setup feature so people can – it's still the convenience aspect of putting the tree in the stand and watering it. We put the fresh cut on site so people don't need a saw when they get their tree. And we also offer the removal aspect. So I welcome Amazon's awareness to the industry. I think it's something that a lot of people didn't even know existed. And just to the point of the tree farms, I mean, they're a critical aspect to this, and we'll never be able to replace the atmosphere of being able to go pick out a tree. And for a lot of the people with time, that's a great way to get a tree. We really like farms.
Chris, also wanted to ask you a little bit about the environmental impact of natural trees versus artificial. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. That's actually one of the reasons why I started. An artificial tree usually has a lifespan. For the research I read, they have a lifespan of 7 to 8 years. The biggest producer of artificial trees are China. So they have a pretty large footprint. They ended up, typically made out of an oil byproduct. They're shipped from China and then end up in a landfill. So it's really important for us to go from local farms, such as the one in Wisconsin. Most of our trees come from Michigan and Wisconsin, and we try to do everything with premium products that are going to be able to be reused, such as stands. And we really try to focus on getting local supply chains as well. We feel that's one of the most important aspects of the environmental aspect of a Christmas tree. And at the end of the year, if people properly recycle it and mulch it, it just, again, returns back into that whole cycle of Christmas, of agricultural management.
And George, wanted to ask you about how many trees do you sell each year, and how do you just make sure you've got enough on your farm to provide that supply?
Well, that's the big guessing game. You're trying to guess 8 years into the future what size and how many trees you're going to sell. So typically we're selling around 7,000 to 8,000 trees. We bring in about 500 from northern Wisconsin that are taller Fraser firs that we can't grow very well on our farm, but around 7,000 to 8,000 of our own trees. And we're planting about 12,000 seedlings every year now, so we always have a supply into the future. But that's a giant guessing game. So, and I wanted to thank Chris for his comments on the recycling. We're in the real Christmas tree business, and these are important to people. The renewable, 100% recyclable, sustainable industry, and these are all very important things about real Christmas trees.
Very good. Always fun to talk Christmas trees with Chris Hohenstein, the founder of City Tree Delivery, George Richardson with Richardson Adventure Farm in Spring Grove, Illinois. Thanks, both of you, for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we'll check in with U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth about what's happening in Washington. Be sure to tune in live at 11 a.m. for that conversation. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps and find past shows there. It's simple to download. You set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, or if you would like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and thanks for listening.